Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, murder, violence, torture, and sexual assault.
Our army was vanquished by the Swedes. That is incontestable. But one should remember what sort of army it was. They had never seen any field fighting, especially with regular troops. The other regiments consisted of raw recruits, both officers and soldiers. Besides that, there was the Great Famine. In brief, it was like child's play for the Swedes. One cannot, then, be surprised that against such an old, disciplined, and experienced army, these untried pupils got the worst of it. The victory, then, was indeed a sad and severe blow to us. It seemed to rob us of all hope for the future, and to come from the wrath of God. But now, when we think of it rightly, we ascribe it rather to the goodness of God than his anger. For if we had conquered then, when we knew as little of war as of government, this piece of luck might have had unfortunate consequences. That we lived through this disaster, or rather this fortune, forced us to be industrious, laborious, and experienced. Tsar Peter I, following the Russian army's defeat at Narva. Charles had just crossed the Dwina River and delivered defeat to the main Saxon army opposing him. The Saxons, however, were able to retreat in good order, and since the Swedish cavalry was still not over the river, Charles was unable to pursue his defeated enemy. Prior to this crossing, the King of Saxony and Poland, Augustus I, was able to come to a mutually beneficial agreement with Tsar Peter I. The Treaty of Bursin gave large amounts of money to Saxony and also provided a Russian army corps to the Holy Roman Elector. Charles, meanwhile, was determined to remove Augustus I from his position as King of Poland. He did this in the hopes of securing a quote-unquote lasting peace between the two countries, at Poland's expense. The Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania was a massive geopolitical entity which existed throughout the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. In terms of military prestige and power, the Kingdom of Poland was remembered for their elite cavalry. Amongst these men, the Winged Hussars are the most famous. Their disciplined, lightning-fast charges broke numerous enemies of the Commonwealth. Most famously, Polish cavalry lifted the Ottoman siege of Vienna and prevented the city's fall in 1683. By the start of the 18th century, Poland was not the same power it once was. John Sobieski, the former king, tried and failed to turn Poland into a hereditary kingdom under his line. But the country was rife with factionalism and noble infighting. Each nobleman acted as a government unto themselves and made decisions to increase their own wealth at the expense of the Polish state as a whole. Following the death of Sobieski, Augustus I of Saxony exploited the corrupt nature of the Polish government in order to become the elected monarch after he bribed and cajoled enough Polish nobles into supporting him. R. Ernest and Trevor N. Dupuy dubbed Augustus, quote, one of the least attractive figures in world history, unquote. This is a serious understatement. While being duplicitous, calculating, ambitious, and conniving, Augustus was also an infamous womanizer. He supposedly fathered upwards of 350 illegitimate children or more. Amongst these children, he took one of his natural daughters as a mistress. Charles and his army moved into Courland, where the first of many diplomatic alarm bells began ringing all across Europe. This was especially true of Sweden's maritime allies, the English and the Dutch, who felt the invasion of Polish Courland would upset their shipping interests in the Baltic. Additionally, the heavy-handed way Charles exploited the people of Danzig irritated many in the free city. Charles and his army spent the rest of the year clearing Courland of Saxon and Polish resistance. They scored numerous small victories against their foes. In April of 1702, Charles officially invaded the Duchy of Lithuania with the objective of assisting the Sapieha family, who were in the middle of an undeclared civil war with other Lithuanian nobles. He captured the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius by assault. This breach of the duchy's autonomy and neutrality alienated many Lithuanian nobility and caused them to side with Russia. A month later, Charles stormed the Polish capital of Warsaw and took it without a fight. Very rapidly, most of Poland came under Swedish possession, but the Saxon army refused battle and maintained their strength. The Saxons and their Fabian tactics were frustrating the Swedes, who were trying to force a decisive engagement. Following his defeat at the crossing of the Dwina, Augustus fell back to Poland's second city, Krakow. Here, his army rested, trained, and awaited reinforcements. Even though Charles and Augustus fought over Poland, the Polish state was technically not at war with Sweden. This neutrality lasted for years, in spite of the numerous campaigns, battles, and sieges which occurred on Polish territory. Nobles within Poland each had their own loyalties. There were pro-Saxon nobles who remained loyal to Augustus, as well as anti-Saxon nobles who sought the aid of Charles. One of the nobles who belonged to the pro-Saxon faction was Prince Hieronyman Lubomirski. He was the leader of over 7,000 cavalry, which was a large part of the Polish crown army. This force combined with the Saxons to form a mighty host of over 24,000 men. The Swedes under Charles had about half this number. In July of 1702, these two armies ran into each other outside the town of Klisau. The Swedes deployed in a traditional battle line, with two large cavalry contingents protecting their flanks. The Saxon-Polish army was set up in a similar way, with the exception of the Polish Crown Army's cavalry, which crowded the Saxon-Polish right. For 2 hours, Charles awaited an assault from the vast army at his front, but none materialized. Charles soon realized he would have to push the issue. He recognized the lack of maneuverability in the Saxon position and decided to redeploy his army so that his left was greatly extended at the expense of his center and right. Additionally, dispersed amongst the Swedish cavalry on their left were a number of pike and musket-armed infantry. This was almost an exact imitation of the tactics employed by Julius Caesar during the Battle of Pharsalus in 48 BCE, during the Roman Civil War against Pompey. As in that battle, the Polish cavalry hoped for an early victory. The winged hussars and dragoons of Poland charged bravely, but they made no headway when confronted by Swedish pike, shot, and lance. Casualties amongst the Poles continued to mount, and soon they were running headlong from the fight. They retreated through their Saxon allies. This ruined the cohesion of many units. The Swedes chased the fleeing Poles and ran directly into the Saxon right, where a brutal melee ensued. In the center and left, the Swedish army held the line against a vastly superior force. The Saxon center was hemmed in by the terrain, which protected their front but rendered them unable to advance on the Swedes. On the Saxon left, the battle was truly decided. A Swedish cavalry force under John Reinskjöld was all that stood against a huge force of Saxon dragoons. The Saxons charged the Swedes, and they likely would have annihilated them if they had not stopped to fire their pistols and perform a caracol. This was a military maneuver where the horsemen wheeled their horses in a circle in front of the enemy while firing their pistols and reloading on the retreat. Due to this, Reinskjold was given the time he needed to assemble a counterattack, and they charged the circling Saxons. This broke the entire force. At the same time, the situation on the Saxon right was rapidly deteriorating. The Swedes had managed to envelop this flank, and they were now threatening the rear of the Saxon host, while their center was being pushed by increasingly aggressive Swedish thrusts. Rather than risk further destruction, the Saxon general wisely pulled his forces out. They successfully extricated themselves, in spite of Swedish pursuit. Once more, the Saxon army was defeated, but not destroyed. At the cost of 1,000 Swedes, 4,400 Poles and Saxons were made casualties. Additionally, the Swedish army captured all the Saxon baggage and artillery. Amongst the loot was the tent of Augustus, which he had originally looted from the Ottoman Sultan. Overall, the Battle of Klizau showed that the rapid, all-encompassing victories which Charles had relied on thus far were not materializing in the Polish campaign. It also showed that the professionalism and aggressiveness of Swedish arms were more than a match for the superior manpower of Saxony and Poland. In either case, the Battle of Klizau is considered a hallmark victory for Charles, since it proved his worth as a strategic commander. He did not simply rush headlong into the fight. He was a true master at recognizing terrain disadvantages and capitalizing on poor moves by his enemy. For example, his decision to redeploy his men in the face of a hostile army could be considered reckless. But this move proved a genius on the battlefield and was the sole reason Swedish arms were successful that day. One politically important casualty of the battle was the Duke of Holstein Gottorp, who was mortally wounded by a cannonball as the Swedish army began their redeployment. This was a major blow for the king personally, and the duke's death would have consequences down the road, both for the Dukedom of Holstein and the Kingdom of Sweden. Conflicts were raging not just in Eastern and Northern Europe, but also in Western and Southern Europe. The War of the Spanish Succession raged across the globe, spawning conflicts and sub-conflicts for nearly a decade and a half. The war would decide the new King of Spain. The previous monarch, Carlos II, was incredibly inbred. He died at around the same time as Swedish forces claimed victory at Narva. Battle lines were quickly drawn. France and their allies were on one side, while a grand coalition of nations, which included England, the Netherlands, and the Habsburg Empire, were on the other. Swedish involvement on either side could have changed the conflict completely. This created a new geopolitical minefield for Charles and his precarious empire. Following the Battle of Klizau, Augustus searched for peace with Charles. Charles rejected all of his terms. He claimed this was in the hopes of gaining a more quote-unquote permanent peace settlement through the destruction of Poland's ability to wage war. Augustus still had the majority of the nobility on his side, so Charles felt that he had to continue his campaign of coercion, violence, and diplomacy. Otherwise, any peace signed would only be temporary. He wanted to invade Saxony directly, but both sides of the War of the Spanish Succession were extremely worried about the possibility of an undefeated Swedish army entering the heart of Germany. As peace negotiations fell apart, Charles moved on to Krakow, which was captured by the end of July 1702. This occupation of Poland's second city would not last long, and possession of Krakow would be up in the air in the coming years. Behind the Swedish advance, the Polish population began to bristle at the breach of their autonomy. Charles now found himself in a similar position to that of his grandfather, Charles X. He was confronted by the recalcitrant peasantry of Poland, who began a war of national liberation against their Swedish occupiers. Guerrilla raids, ambuscades, and highway robbery were the norm in the Polish countryside. Polish light cavalry was especially effective at causing havoc amongst the Swedish supply system. Charles did not abide any rebelliousness from the Poles. He began a campaign of systematic terror and murder against the civilian population. Charles wrote of these operations, saying, quote, "I hear that our men are being attacked. It would be best that those who cause this be destroyed through plundering and burning, even those who, guilty or not, find themselves living at the spot of occurrence. On our end, we have burned down at least 3 or 4 villages and a large farmstead. Every location where the foe can be found is burnt down. Recently, I had a whole town reduced to ashes and the inhabitants strung up." Unquote. Michael Glaser writes, quote, "Letters and journals of officers such as Reinskjöld reveal even more brutal reprisals against the local populace." Unquote. The next major engagement between Saxon-Polish forces and the Swedish would occur at Pultusk in April of 1703. Charles was at the head of 2,100 cavalry when he encountered almost 6,000 Saxons defending the river island city of Pultusk. The Saxon commander became incredibly skittish when he discovered Charles XII was bearing down upon his infantry. He made a severe tactical blunder when he attempted to withdraw his forces over the river and into the city proper. Charles once again recognized the precarious position in which the Saxons had placed themselves, and he launched his cavalry contingent without infantry support against the retreating foe. The results were stunning. Swedish cavalry had caught up to the Saxon army before they could properly extricate themselves. This resulted in about half the Saxons being trapped on the wrong side of the river. In no time at all, the Swedish cavalry was utterly victorious, and Saxons were falling back in panic across the only functional bridge to the city, which collapsed and drowned hundreds of routed soldiers. This opened up the road to Thorn, one of the major fortresses in northwest Poland, which was defended by 6,000 of the most elite of the Saxon army. In order to take Thorn, a siege would have to be executed. Sieges were commonplace for the era. In the Great Northern War, there were 70 separate sieges. The Siege of Thorn would drag on for months, as the garrison of the city put up a determined resistance to the Swedes. The length of the siege was wearing on the offensive-minded Charles. At one point, he demanded to lead a quote-unquote forlorn hope of 600 soldiers in a suicide charge in order to capture the gates of the city. He was dissuaded from doing so, but he said, quote, "Where my soldiers are, there also will I be. As for Sweden, I should be no great loss to her, for she has had little profit out of me hitherto." Unquote. Swedish siege guns began arriving in September of 1704. With these guns, the Siege of Thorn became the Bombardment of Thorn. In a matter of weeks, the 2,000 remaining Saxons who were a part of the city's brutalized garrison surrendered themselves. The citizens were forced to pay a massive indemnity to Sweden for the cost of the siege, and the city's walls were reduced to rubble on Charles's orders. Polish politics, meanwhile, were also heading toward a climax. Augustus attempted to call forth a sejm, or diet, of loyal Polish nobles in order to officially bring Poland into the war. This would allow Augustus access to the Crown Army of Poland. However, Augustus miscalculated. In response, a similar sejm was called by anti-Saxon supporters, and it was decided to remove Augustus as the King of Poland in favor of a new candidate. Upon learning of his ousting, Augustus captured and imprisoned those who were the most likely candidates, including the children of the former king, John Sobieski. This shocked many diplomats across Europe. Augustus had few friends left, save Peter I of Russia, who understood that the Saxon army was all that stood between him and Charles. Peter I signed a new treaty with Augustus, which granted the Holy Roman Elector 300,000 rubles annually, as well as a new army corps of 12,000 men. Additionally, Augustus had to promise not to sign a separate peace with Sweden and to keep the war on Polish soil. Charles was preoccupied with trying to find a puppet ruler to sit upon the Polish throne. This was easier said than done. Amongst those not imprisoned by Augustus, there were several choices. They included a native Polish candidate, a pro-French candidate, or a pro-Allied candidate. Each had their own issues. The pro-French candidate couldn't appease the Allies, and the same situation arose, in reverse, with the pro-Allied choice. This left the native Polish selection as the only possible option, but there were few from whom Charles could choose. Most did not have the ability, as well as the prestige, to govern the ever-rebellious Polish and Lithuanian Commonwealth. In time, Charles would settle upon the governor of Posen, Stanislaus Leszinski. Swedish officers, like Arvel Horn, were under no presumptions about the Swedish pick. Horn predicted that once Swedish forces left Poland, the entire country would become a hotbed for rebellion and civil war. He was proved completely correct. Stanislaus would be elected king under Swedish military supervision. Finally, Charles had gotten what he wanted, and Augustus was no longer king of Poland. However, the Polish supporters of Augustus refused to recognize the legitimacy of this election. A pro-Saxon confederation declared war on Stanislaus and his faction in 1704. Poland was plunged into a civil war which raged on and off for another 3 decades. It was one of the main reasons Poland was so easily carved up by Austria, Prussia, and Russia at the end of the 18th century. It was around this time that Charles was asked to enter an alliance with the newly formed Kingdom of Prussia. Prussia may have been a brand new entity, but they had an incredibly strong army and were strategically positioned on the borders of German-controlled Sweden, Russia, and Poland-Lithuania. Their 47,000-man army would have been extremely helpful in Sweden's campaigns against Peter, but Charles refused to enter into an alliance with them. Their diplomats were asking for parts of Courland, as well as Polish land, which would have made Prussia a contiguous country. Charles found this to be unacceptable, as he believed the loss of Courland would hurt his country's food supply and geopolitical situation. The fact that Charles refused such a deal shows he was bullheaded and unable to compromise, especially when he set his mind on an objective. Following the coronation of Stanislaus in early 1705, Carl Gustafsson Klingspor says, quote, "It came to our good king's mind no longer to permit Augustus to sleep in security, but at once to attack his strong city of Lemberg," unquote. In reality, Lemberg was a completely isolated and out-of-the-way target. The city's capture would do nothing for the war effort, but Charles demanded the fortress capitulate to him. His sole reasoning was that Lemberg had never been taken before. This fortress had resisted the Ottomans on numerous occasions, but it fell to the Swedes in a matter of hours. Unfortunately for Charles, his assault of Lemberg left Warsaw bereft of adequate defenses, and the few thousand inside capitulated to a rapid-moving Saxon-Russian army led by the turncoat Patkel. King Stanislaus I was forced to flee the capital in which he had only recently been crowned. Charles once again marched his men on Warsaw and had to capture the city in a short fight. However, the majority of the Saxon army escaped destruction once more. Throughout the summer and early autumn of 1705, Charles hunkered down in Poland and awaited reinforcements which were constantly delayed. One of the few battles of note which occurred in the 1705 campaign was at Punitz. Charles was at the head of around 2,000 Swedish cavalry when he encountered over 4,000 entrenched Saxons. He refused to await reinforcements and charged his horsemen in 3 separate head-on attacks. In spite of his lack of tactical planning, the boldness of the Swedish attack forced the Saxons back. But it was at the cost of many Swedish horsemen. Of all his battles, Punitz was the least tactically sound. Charles would learn from this Pyrrhic victory, and adjust his tactics for future fights. Reinforcements from Swedish Germany did not fully arrive until early 1706. Charles refused to remain in camp for much longer, and he drew up plans for a winter campaign designed to crush Russian and Saxon designs. He said that since his soldiers, quote, have enjoyed their winter quarters in the summer, it is only right that they should take the field in winter, unquote. He moved his army not a moment too soon. A Russian army of over 41,000 was invading Lithuania and moving into Poland proper. They were wintering in Grodno. Meanwhile, a Saxon-Russian force from Germany was invading Poland from the other side. The end goal was to catch Charles in a massive death grip. Charles split his men and took the majority of his forces, 21,000, towards Grodno to besiege the place. Around 8,000 to 10,000 Swedes remained behind. They were ordered to frustrate the Saxon-Russian army in the west. This smaller Swedish contingent was headed by General John Reinskjöld. Within Grodno, there were over 20,000 Russian troops who were now cut off from the outside world by the Swedish siege. 10,000 Russians died of exposure and disease inside the walled city, but they managed a daring escape south into Ukraine after several months of Swedish strangulation. As the Swedish army advanced on Grodno, Augustus, who was present with the Russian army, used this opportunity to split off from the Russian effort and head west in the hopes of combining his 7,000 with the 21,000 invading from that direction. Reinskjöld was aware of this attempted merging, and he was determined to interrupt the Saxon strategy, whatever the cost. He decided to engage the 20,000 to his front around the town of Fraustadt. Upon encountering the Saxon army, the few units of Swedish infantry defending the town feigned a mass retreat. The Swedish cavalry, however, remained in place, threatening the flanks of the Saxons the entire time. As the Saxons pushed forward to chase their quote-unquote retreating enemy from the field, Reinskjöld gave the signal to his infantry to charge against the Saxons. Michael Glaser says that the Gapa tactics of Sweden were so aggressive, quote, that several battalions never fired a volley before engaging in combat, unquote. As the Swedish infantry held the enemy in the center, Swedish cavalry pushed the flanks in rear. The battle now resembled the famous Battle of Cannae, when Rome was utterly destroyed by the Carthaginians, led by Hannibal Barca. The results were completely devastating for the Saxon-Russian army. They suffered over 15,000 casualties compared to 600 Swedish casualties. When Augustus discovered the overwhelming defeat his men had faced, he retired to Krakow for the winter, where he hoped to rebuild his forces. Charles congratulated Reinskjöld for his magnificent victory and named him a field marshal immediately. Charles and his army marched back into Poland and converged with Reinskjöld's forces. Charles had finally decided to invade Saxony. He did this because the situation throughout the rest of Europe was playing out in the favor of the Allies. 1706 was a crucial year for the War of the Spanish Succession. At Ramillies, John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough, leveled the French army facing him, inflicting over 15,000 casualties upon them. Meanwhile, in northern Italy, Prince Eugene of Savoy kicked the French out of the peninsula entirely at the decisive Battle of Turin. Both engagements were crucial, as they gave Charles the breathing room he needed to invade Saxony without imperiling a larger European conflict. This whole time, Charles maintained that he was fighting only to ensure peace. Many across Europe were baffled by this response. Diplomats across the continent had been trying to get a peace deal for years. Charles almost always ignored these entreaties in the hopes of quote-unquote improving his position. Many started calling Charles a tyrant and a war hawk, who only continued the conflict to increase his own glory. Michael Glaser maintains that Charles was constantly reminding himself of the deathbed promises he made to his father and the private pledges he made to his god. Arriving in Saxony, at the head of his forces, he proclaimed, quote, "The sword does not jest," unquote. He intended to remove Augustus as king of Poland fully, just as he had promised he would, and he would get Augustus to agree to it. In mid-September 1706, Charles and his men halted at Altranstadt, just outside Liegnitz. The Saxon government and people were tired, and their small country had suffered in excess of 50,000 casualties thus far. Augustus also seemed to realize that the jig was up. He submitted to Swedish demands. Michael Glaser says, quote, "Augustus would renounce the Polish throne, recognize Stanislaus, immediately cease his alliance with Peter, and expel Russian troops, and relinquish any prisoners and deserters," unquote. This meant that Patkel, the one who started the anti-Swedish coalition, was finally in Swedish hands. Carl Gustafsson Klingspor says, quote, "He was awarded his just deserts. After the trial was ended, a Swedish officer, who was acting as a clerk, read with a high voice a paper upon which were these words, 'This man, who had been proven a traitor unto his country, be broken and quartered as a reparation for his crimes and an example to others,'" unquote. He continues later on, quote, "Patkel's right arm was first struck, as it took the executioner 3 mighty strokes to sever it from the body. Patkel then shrieked quite loudly, crying withal incessantly the name of Jesus, this continuing until both arms and legs had been broken. And altogether he received 15 blows. The poor sinner Patkel then cast his eyes upon the captain, praying, 'For the love of God, strike off my head! Strike off my head!' It took 3 good strokes before the head fell off," unquote. Upon his death, his body was further desecrated and quartered. His remains were placed upon spears set up around the Swedish camp. Klingspor concludes his thoughts on the whole ordeal by saying, quote, "I observed that the army was melancholy during this execution," unquote. Before the quote-unquote peace was publicly announced, Augustus tried one last time to have his cake and eat it, too. He agreed to end the Russian alliance, but he refused to tell Peter this fact. This was done in the hopes of getting further Russian economic assistance. He tried to play the part of the dutiful ally to the bitter end, even invading southern Poland with an army. Augustus then tried to inform the local Swedish commander that his offensive movements were only a ruse and that Swedish forces could and should retreat. The Swedish commander, who was not aware of recent peace talks, believed this to be a clever deception on Augustus's part, and he refused to retreat from his position. A battle inevitably ensued, which resulted in a Swedish defeat. This nearly upset the entire peace negotiations, until Charles made the bilateral move to announce the peace deal publicly to the rest of Europe. The duplicity of Augustus was plain for all to see, and he was finally out of cards to play. He bowed out for now, but he would be back when the time was right. Charles would spend the next several months, well into the new year of 1707, in the heart of Europe, where he would court diplomats from across the continent. For this, Nisbet Arbane dubbed King Charles XII, quote, "the arbiter of Europe," unquote. Before leaving Germany for a massive invasion of Russia, Charles had to settle accounts with the Habsburg Emperor Joseph I. Charles threatened to march his army on Vienna if the emperor refused to recognize the rights of Protestants living in Silesia, who were supposedly being oppressed. Charles argued that he had every right to demand satisfaction from the emperor on this issue, since Sweden was a guarantor of the Peace of Westphalia, as well as a defender of all Protestants in Europe. The emperor submitted to Charles's demands, and when he heard protests from papal emissaries, he remarked thus, quote, "You may think yourself happy that the King of Sweden did not propose to make me a Lutheran, for if he had, I do not know what I might have done," unquote. As he marched through Silesia, bound for Russia, Charles was hailed by the Silesian people as a hero, and thousands bid the king good luck on his coming campaigns. Fresh off his victories in Flanders, the Duke of Marlborough was sent to Altranstadt to ease the tension between the Allies and the Empire of Sweden and figure out Charles's next move. The Allies were clearly worried that the age-old alliance between France and Sweden would be rekindled during this lull in the Great Northern War and the War of the Spanish Succession. Besides being a superb commander, the Duke of Marlborough was also a tactful diplomat, who arrived in late April of 1707. King Charles was busy living like a rank-and-file soldier, and he wore the same dirty cavalry uniform for days on end. He and the Duke got along well enough, but the Duke found Charles and his plainness to be a symptom of quote-unquote vaingloriousness, while Charles found the Duke to be a quote-unquote dandy and someone who played at war instead of fighting with his men. Overall, however, both men remained cautiously respectful of each other. Upon arriving, the Duke said, quote, "I wish I could serve some campaigns under such a great general as Your Majesty, that I might learn yet what I want to know in the art of war," unquote. Besides this meeting, Charles met with Augustus, his cousin and former enemy. All enmity which existed between the two seemed to disappear upon their official meeting. They embraced each other like old friends, not as two leaders whose armies had fought and killed each other for over 6 years. The difference between the two men physically and aesthetically were obvious. Augustus was ostentatious and lecherous, while Charles was reserved and apathetic. Besides these courtly meetings and diplomatic formalities, Charles traveled incognito to the battle site of Lützen, where a former Swedish king, Gustav II Adolf, fought and died for his Protestant faith during the Thirty Years' War. Upon arriving at the spot where the Swedish king fell, Charles said, quote, "I have tried to live like unto him. May God in his great mercy someday grant me even such a glorious death," unquote. During his downtime, he played chess with his officers. He was notorious for using his king in an offensive manner. Charles stayed in Altranstadt until late 1707, when he finally decided to turn east and destroy the Russian colossus that had been growing fat off Swedish lands. The peasant masses of Saxony came out in droves to see the king, who supposedly could not be killed by bullets. Many also came out to wish him well and beg him to stay. During these many months, Charles extracted vast amounts of wealth from Saxony, but very little of it came from the common man. R. Nisbet Bain says, quote, "The contributions he had levied had fallen for the most part on the privileged classes, who pleaded their exemption from taxation in vain before a king whose cardinal economic maxim is that the rich and noble should pay not less, but more than their poorer brethren," unquote. Germans joined the Swedish ranks en masse, enthused by Charles and his presence in their land. Charles now fielded the largest army he had ever or would ever command. There were over 40,000 troops who were highly trained and magnificently equipped with the best Swedish society could provide. The sight of these tens of thousands of blue-clad warriors filled many diplomats present with dread. Charles marched back into Poland and onward to the most climactic engagement of the Great Northern War. For the past 6 years, he had fought, bled, and wasted valuable time trying to bring Poland to heel. Ultimately, Charles succeeded, and several of his most famous victories occurred during this Polish campaign. These 6 years defined the image of Charles across Europe as well. He was no longer the victimized teenager who took on several opponents and won against the odds. Now he was seen as a bully and a butcher of civilians who cared little for his country's continued existence or the lives of his soldiers. Robert Frost contends, quote, "The Great Northern War was largely won and lost in the Commonwealth of Poland long before 1709. For despite the fact that Charles won every battle that mattered, he was comprehensively outmaneuvered by Peter, who showed a far surer grasp of Polish politics than Charles. Unquote. Peter exerted political power in Poland, but he exerted military power in Swedish Ingria and Courland. Following the disastrous Battle of Narva, Peter cobbled together an army of 23,000 in Novgorod, which he intended to use to halt any further Swedish advances on Russian territory. Peter did not have to wait long for Charles to begin his Polish offensive. This granted Peter the initiative he needed to invade Swedish Ingria in 1701. Opposing Peter were two separate Swedish armies. One was located in the Baltic region, and the other was located in southern Finland. Each force was equally undermanned and often lacking in supply and ammunition. The Russian plan for war against Sweden was highly influenced by the drubbing they had received at Narva. Peter gave explicit instructions to his army commanders. They were to engage the enemy only when they had overwhelming numerical superiority. If confronted by the Swedes, Russian generals were to retreat and save their army at all hazard. Peter was determined to choose when and where the fight occurred, and this gave him the edge over the aggressive Gapa charges of the Swedes. The Russians won their first victory against an outnumbered force of Swedes on December 29, 1701, at Erastfö in Livonia. Russian propaganda claimed it was a stunning defeat for the Swedes. In reality, the Russians had compelled a small brigade of Swedes to retreat while also capturing a few guns. Regardless, this bolstered Russian morale, which slowly repaired itself while Charles was stuck in Poland. One of the main reasons Russia even entered the war was to gain a warm water port in the Baltic. Peter believed that strong nations had strong navies. This belief was espoused hundreds of years before it was popularized by naval thinkers in the late 19th century. Two Swedish forts guarded the entrance to the Neva River, which would have to be captured for Peter's dream to be made reality. A 12,000-man army, led by Peter personally, besieged the fort of Notberg on the mouth of the Neva. The small Swedish garrison resisted stubbornly, even inflicting more casualties on the Russians than the Swedish had men. But the overwhelming force of the bombardment and countless Russian assaults were taking their toll. The fort's garrison surrendered the next day, rather than be wiped out by another Russian assault. By May 1703, the Swedish sister fort of Nyenskans fell to the Russians as well. Following the conquests of these two forts, Peter laid the foundation for, quote, the Russian answer to Amsterdam, to London, to Venice, unquote, according to Michael W. Simmons. Peter named the city which sprang up around the forts St. Petersburg. According to Russian legend, Peter buried a box around the original foundations of the city, which is said to contain the bones of Russia's patron saint. As he did this, an eagle, the symbol of the Romanov house, supposedly landed on a tree right above where Peter stood. Peter had built the foundation for a city, but it was totally empty. He needed a population to work and live there, so he demanded the nobility of Russia move to St. Petersburg from Moscow and bring all their serfs with them. More than this, he demanded they all build their new houses, quote, in the English style, unquote. Life in the city was hard at first. Many died from the swamp-like conditions which bred disease in the summer months. Besides this, Russians were not used to their new life on the water. Few Russian nobles would dare enter a boat unless directly ordered by Peter. It took generations of Russian serfs taming the wilderness before St. Petersburg truly shined as the new Russian capital. Starting in 1704, Peter began his invasion of the Baltic provinces and besieged Dorpat as well as Narva. Dorpat held out relentlessly, with over 5,000 Russians dying throughout the course of the siege. Narva was even more zealous in their stubbornness. The Swedish government made numerous attempts to lift the siege or at least provide supplies for the men inside the city. These all failed, and each day Russian siege artillery inched closer. On August 7, 1704, one of the main Swedish defensive bastions collapsed. Russians stormed the unexpected breach, while the Swedish garrison fought stubbornly to hold the line. R. Nisbet Bain says, quote, 3,000 Russians fell in the breach, but might prevailed at last. The Tsar was Lord of Narva, unquote. Russian units began a massacre of the Swedish population inside Narva, and only halted when Peter demanded they cease. Swedish armies in Poland responded in kind and executed scores of Russian prisoners in a series of revenge killings. The Russians moved on to the rest of Livonia and Courland. Here a small Swedish army under Adam Ludwig Lohenhaupt was defying Russian and Polish armies many times his size. In 1703, he completely routed 5,200 Poles and Russians with only 1,300 men at his command. For the next 5 years, Lohenhaupt utterly frustrated all Russian attempts at invasion. In 1704, with only 6,000 men, he crushed a Polish-Russian army of 12,000 at Jakobstadt. In 1705, Peter launched a committed invasion of Lithuania with the objective of overrunning Lohenhaupt's small army. At Gammerhof, 20,000 Russians launched an impetuous attack against Lohenhaupt and his 7,000 men. The Swedish resistance was so ferocious that the Russian army was crippled and forced to retreat, but the Swedes were equally ravaged. As a result, Lohenhaupt opted to abandon Courland for the defense of Riga, one of the most important cities in the entire Swedish Empire. When Peter discovered Charles was invading Saxony, he sent armies into Poland to pillage the countryside, and they tore a path clean through central Poland before attempting to intercept Charles and his forces on their way to Russia. At the same time, Peter frantically sent diplomats across Europe in the hopes of brokering a peace with Sweden. He promised to return all the land Russia had captured, save for the Neva Valley and parts of Ingria. This would have granted Russia the seaport that they so desperately craved, and it would have returned nearly all of Sweden's lost territory on the European mainland, but Charles refused the deal outright. He felt that to lose Ingria was to lose the entire Swedish Empire. He had reason to argue such a position. Already in 1705, Russia had flexed its naval might in the Baltic, and although the engagement ended in a Swedish victory, it showed the Russians were able to be as industrious as the Swedes in the ways of war. Peter had learned much from his enemies. Defeat and adversity led him to be a better strategist. Peter adapted the Russian army into a professional force which could compete with Sweden if the circumstances were right. Charles, however, continued to view the Russians as quote-unquote barbarians, who were unable to learn new tricks. This bigoted view of Russians contributed greatly to the defeat of Charles. Peter, meanwhile, remained awestruck and rightly afraid of what the Swedish lion could do to his forces if given the opportunity. This begrudging fear forced Peter to adapt and overcome the supposed quote-unquote superiority of Swedish arms. Peter proved that those who discount their enemy based simply on their past experiences and perceived superiority are doomed to fail. Additionally, Russia had ample time to rebuild and reforge their armed forces while Charles had his sights set on Poland. A quote by Napoleon began to ring true for Charles as he and his army faced Russian forces. Quote, "You must not fight too often with one enemy, or you will teach him all your art of war." Unquote. Charles was finally ready to crush the Russian threat, which taunted his flank. At the head of his 40,000 men, he splashed his horse across the Vistula River on New Year's Day, 1708. He did not realize it at the time, but it would be the last time he crossed that mighty river, and Michael Glaser says it would prove to be, quote, his own personal Rubicon, unquote. The Swedish army was planning a campaign designed to capture Moscow and reduce Russia to little more than a memory. he would have to battle marauding armies, disease, and the weather itself in order to achieve his goal. To hear whether Charles succeeded, you'll have to wait for the next episode of Turning Tides, Tyr in Exile. I'm your host, Joseph Pescone. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support, and thank you for listening.
If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, M-O-V-O-P-H-O-T-O. Thank you again.